Okay, tonight we have the exciting privilege of studying someone who honestly I knew very little about. Just, I think I say that before every person so far. But someone that I really knew very little about, and that is, I don't know why there's a mark there, Rav Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg. Rav Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg, as we'll learn in a second, lived during one of, I think, the most fascinating... Yeah, I have some more here. One of the most fascinating periods in Jewish history, and that is during the time of the Enlightenment at the beginning of the Reform Movement. Now, what we're going to discuss tonight is how Orthodoxy, how modern Orthodoxy, as we'll call it, how Orthodox Judaism survived against all odds in Western Europe. And if you had asked someone in 1809 or around that time, the odds of Orthodoxy not only surviving, but thriving in places like Paris or London or Berlin, the answer would be a resounding no. And if you ask someone 50 years from then the exact same question, the answer would be even less of a chance of Orthodoxy surviving. And of course, we know that that was the major battle that was being waged, what we'll call, between the traditionalists, those who were trying to maintain a traditionalist approach to our texts, and the reformers. So, you could be here tonight. I don't know why there's this liner. I just spoke to my mom in Boston, and that's a generous depiction of what it's like there. It took her an hour to get home, a 5-minute drive. So there was a lot of traffic, but thank God instead we're here tonight. And thank God we're here not just because we have beautiful weather, it's a little chilly outside, but also because we have the opportunity to learn together this evening. Okay. There's this line right there. Anyone want to know Max Apples? Any Apple people here? Yeah, I don't know why that's...
There's...
No, it's on my computer. I don't know why. Deal tonight. Okay. Yeah, I can't figure it out. I'm really not sure, and I can't figure it out. It's too much pressure on me right now. Okay. Okay. We'll be able to read it unless. Okay. When we talk about the movement, again, loosely termed the Reform Movement, which is the challenges of Reform, I think this paragraph, which is a little difficult to read, I'll read it for us, to me summarizes a lot of what the challenges faced in the time period in which we're talking. Thus, the first religious reformers in Central Europe did not confront a Jewish community that was united in its Judaism. That was one of the major aspects that the Reform tried to capitalize, was that for the first time, there was what we'll call the un-ghettoization of the Jewish people. When you live in very ghetto communities, in very insular communities, so it's very easy to maintain a sense of control. The second those communities start opening up, people start feeling a sense of autonomy, it becomes a lot more difficult to convey that. And so it says, on the contrary, many, many of its members were severely disoriented. While most Jews, especially in the smaller towns, remain more or less steadfast in their traditional faith and practice, the intensity of Jewish life in the larger cities has been much diminished and the communities factionalized. The impact of two complementary forces, both external, had become increasingly evident. The first was the policy of the governments to reduce the spheres of Jewish autonomy and the effectiveness of the Jewish community control. In other words, they wanted to lessen the communal control, which obviously was able to keep a very close-knit community together. Thus, dissent can no longer be suppressed. The walls of separation from the outside world no longer maintained intact, right? If, in other words, if you live in a very insular community, it becomes very easy to block out anyone who feels differently than you. The second you open those communities up, so obviously then you open yourself up to differing perspectives and differing ways of practicing Judaism as well. For example, even to this day, if you go to many communities in Europe, ironically somewhat, those communities look very different than American communities. American communities are completely open. And that's why you could have on any given block in any different community, an Orthodox shul, Reform shul, conservative shul, Reconstructionist shul, partnership minyanim, could have a whole slew of different genres of what Judaism looks like. If you go to certain European communities, even to this day, that's not the case. There's one communal structure of how Judaism is practiced, and that basically dictates what Judaism looks like for everybody else. So for example, if you go to Berlin nowadays even, which is, as I said, very ironic. But if you go to Berlin nowadays, there's an Orthodox rabbi who presides over the Jewish community largely. Now that obviously is being pushed to the limits, and there are obviously many within Berlin itself, in Germany itself, who want to disband that notion. Because if I'm a liberal Jew, I don't want an Orthodox rabbi telling me what to do. Okay? Well, this was all happening in the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th centuries, and that's the dissent can no longer be suppressed. The walls of separation from the outside world were starting to break down. That's factor number one. Factor number two, the second force, was the more hospitable attitude toward Jews on the part of enlightened elements in Christian society. So long as our Christian friends hated us and persecuted us and killed us, so it was very easy to convince people that that's them and we're Jews and you don't want anything to do with them and you should maintain your affinity to the Jewish community. The second, all of a sudden these Christians aren't these big bad Christians that we once thought they were, and all of a sudden they're my best friends, and by the way, they're probably acting even nicer than the Jews are acting at certain times. So it becomes much more difficult to argue that we're the chosen people and they're the quote-unquote medieval image of the big bad Christians. Okay? It was the latter, based on universal inclusive conceptions of humanity, which drew Jews into broader cultural identification. Again, so long as you could convince people, in the medieval ages it was very easy to convince people. Christians were creating the pogroms, the Christians were persecuting the Jews. It was very easy to say, stay with the Jewish people, we don't want so much mingling with them. In fact, if you remember from previous classes, I spoke about, this is one of the primary differences between what the Sephardi communities have gone through in the medieval ages versus what the Ashkenazi communities have gone through. Sephardic communities classically had a much warmer relationship with their non-Jewish hosts, which meant there was much more interaction between the Sephardi communities and their non-Jewish hosts. If you were living in Ashkenazi Jewry in the medieval ages, in northern France and Germany, you wanted nothing to do with the Christians. As Rabbi Horowitz spoke about a little bit on Shabbos, right? In other words, the policeman down the block was not a friend of yours. He was the person who you went to and you never came back. And that was the mentality. And so long as that was the mentality, I didn't want to be open to their cultures. So broader cultural identification soon made traditional Judaism seem excessively particularistic and inappropriate in a modern world. If we're all expected to be the same, if we're all equals amongst men, so what does it matter if I'm a Jew and you're a Christian? We should be. We have a similar set of values. I'm not the chosen people. I don't have the be-all and end-all, the right approach. The Torah, all of a sudden, needs to be adapted for a modern world. By the way, lest you think these are strictly challenges that took place in the end of the 18th and beginning of the 19th century, these are challenges that we face to this day. Rabbi Goldberg, 2 years ago, gave a whole series of sermons on being different. Right? That was not a very popular culture, very popular concept during the Enlightenment. So how did the Jewish community respond? So there were a number of responses, but I want to read you one description, and this is from a very fascinating book, J.M. Harris, How Do We Know This? Midrash and the Fragmentation of Modern Judaism. I bought it off Amazon. It's a very fascinating book. He writes the following. The more insightful among the Orthodox recognized early on that the responses generated by an earlier age, when it too was under cultural pressure, would not be effective in the 19th century without considerable refinement. Again, you could literally transpose these exact conversations to conversations that we have nowadays. right? The response that took place in the early 20th century, the 1950s, is no longer applicable to a younger generation. We need a new leadership in place to deal with it. That's exactly what they're describing then. We thus find that as the century wore on, a marked shift is discernible in the attitude toward the Bible, its language, and rabbinic exegesis amongst a small group of Orthodox commentaries. Why the Bible, while never wavering in their commitment to certain basic metaphysical and historical beliefs, the authors of these works pushed the contours of rabbinic learning to new directions. A change was happening around them, and there was a small group of rabbis that recognized that change and said, if we don't take our head out of the sand and respond to the change, then Judaism is simply going to, Orthodox Judaism, is simply going to lose its relevancy. Can anyone, based on last year's class, and I'm testing you now, name me some of these names? Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, who actually lives a little bit later than Rav Yaakov Zvi Mecklenburg. That was his whole raison d'etre. That's what he was trying to do as well. Any other names? The Malbim is another person you learned about last year, okay? Why the Tanakh? Notice he writes here, marked shift is discernible in their attitude to the Bible. Why did they write philosophical works? If I really wanted to combat Reform theology, why didn't I write a philosophical work combating that theology? Why specifically, if I want to create a polemic against the Reformers, I write a commentary on the Torah? Well, the answer is because how are the Reformers attacking Orthodoxy? They're not writing philosophical works. They're taking the exact premise, they're taking our exact Torah, and they're playing around with it a little bit to suit their theological needs. And so if you want to combat that, the way you're going to do that is by writing a commentary on the Torah. The whole thing takes place over who has a legitimacy, who has the legitimate understanding of the Torah. And when there are those who are trying to recreate interpretations in the Torah, what do you have to do? You have to combat that with a commentary on the Torah. Think about what we learned 3 weeks ago with the Radak. If you remember Radak, almost his entire work on Tehillim is a polemic against Christian theology. Well, if you remember back then, I don't remember what I had breakfast this morning, but if you remember back then, what are you going to remember? He's one of the few who works his anti-Christian polemic into his works, into his commentary itself. So you ask the same question, why didn't he write it as a theological work, separate and distinct from a Torah commentary? The answer is because if the Christians were using our religious texts to misconstrue it and create a Christian theology, then the way to battle it was writing your own commentary on the Christian text. Okay, this is not a new thing. Moses Mendelssohn, we think of as the father of the Reform movement. He wasn't. Moses Mendelssohn was an Orthodox Jew. Okay, he pushed the limits a little bit, and his grandchildren, in his religious descendants, so to speak, they take what he wrote and create into this Reform movement. But towards the end of his life, one of the major works that he writes in partnership with a few other people is a commentary on Tanakh in German. Now, the fact that it was in German is quite important, but the fact that he wrote a commentary on Tanakh is exactly the point I'm trying to make. If you wanted relevancy in this discussion, so you had to put out a commentary on Tanakh. It's the exact same reason that Rav Hirsch put out a commentary on Tanakh and the Malbim put out it. All of these battles were taking place over how to read the actual text of Tanakh. And the personality that we're going to read about tonight, here are just a few names. I'm not going to go into them as much. I just want you to see there were other important traditionalists taking place at the time. Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, who we're going to learn about next year in People of the Book. I already have the whole... It's all planned out already. Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, we're going to learn about, and we learned a little bit about Zionism. Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, who is, of course, one of the... Barnes, all these people who you may have learned about when you learned about Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, they were other important traditionalists living at the time. The personality that we're going to learn about tonight, Rav Yaakov Zvi Mecklenburg, is really one of the first rabbis, German rabbis, to counterattack the Reform attempt to take the Torah and prove its irrelevancy and therefore to turn it around and make it relevant again. His entire work, as we'll see, is a polemic against the Reform movement. Every single component of it. And he writes it in his introduction. Unfortunately, I don't have an English translation, or I would have brought you the whole thing. It's a magnificent introduction. I'm going to quote from it a lot here. I actually posted on BRJC, if anyone... Eliyahu Monk translated his works. But it's $444 on Amazon. So unless any of you wanted to sponsor it, you have my translation that I had to work on today. But there is a translation. It's a magnificent work. But he writes in the outset that his entire purpose is to create a polemic, is to argue against the reformers, those who are trying to create a new movement within Judaism. Okay, just a few pieces of information. Reb Mecklenburg was a student of Rabbi Akiva Eiger, again, a name that might be famous to us. He started off in business. He was a businessman for the first 40-some-odd years of his life. Well, it didn't go very well, because in 1831, bordering on bankruptcy, he leaves business and becomes the Rav of Konigsberg. Okay, now, we're going to learn about that in a little bit, why that's a significant place, but he holds that position until his death. His entire life was vigorously opposing the Reform movement, and he did so by responding directly to their understanding of halacha and its origins. I'm obviously going to explain all this as we go on, but his entire life was battling this movement of modernity, and he, recognizing that he has to give a little bit, goes right at it. And he doesn't hide away from the conversation. He goes right to the conversation and addresses what he believes is the number one issue: how they're using the Torah itself and Chazal themselves to prove the validity of Reform Judaism. He was bothered by what he saw as an abandonment of traditional Judaism. He exhibited an unyielding opposition to Reform ideology, provided the impetus to his work that we're going to study tonight, HaKitav VeHaKabbalah. Now, I translated that for you on that page. But HaKitav means the scripture, in other words, the words. And HaKabbalah, there it says the tradition, okay? But for us, that's going to mean rabbinic tradition. Now, the name of his work gives away the entire purpose of the work. HaKitav VeHaKabbalah. His entire purpose is going to be to reconcile midrashic thought or rabbinic thought with the actual literal meaning of the verse. So I'll give you an example. Okay? Who here has ever read a rabbinic text? It could be a Rashi, it could be a midrash, anything on the bottom of an art scroll, basically. And said, come on. Like, where'd you pull that story out of, Rashi? Or where in the world did the midrash get that from? Well, let's be honest. Come on. Don't be shy, right? We've all had that moment. And if you're not raising your hand, you're shy and you're lying. What? What? Yeah, Dina in the box. I could list ad nauseam. But we've all had that experience. We've read a Rashi, we've read a Midrashic text, we've read a Gemara, and we scratch our head and say, how did they read that story into the Pasuk? Well, I got news for you. We might ask that and be okay with the answers. But if you're trying to contest the validity of Rabbinic Judaism, you're going to point to those Midrashim and say, the same way you made up that stuff out of thin air, I can make up my own stuff out of thin air. You're a rabbi, I'm a rabbi. What makes you any better than me? And so if you can make up a story and an understanding of the text, then I can make up an understanding of the text. That gives me, as a reformist, a tremendous amount of credibility. So one of the things that HaKitav VeHaKabbalah, Reb Mecklenburg, is going to do is he's going to say, not so fast, chief. Right? All of these crazy midrashim, all of these crazy ideas that we see in Rashi that we scratch our heads over, they're all found in the literal text of the Torah. Wait a second. They're all found in the literal text of the Torah. I'm an intelligent person who've been in day school for God knows how long, spent probably over $1 million of my parents' money to get a Jewish education. I don't see it in the text. The answer is no, and this is what Mecklenburg is going to say. I'm an idiot. Me, Philip Moskowitz, I don't know anything. He's going to say, if you really know how to read the text, you'll see it as clear as day. And I'm going to help you. And that's his entire work. The entire purpose of his work is to read rabbinic texts into the literal interpretation of the Torah to show that it's not written Torah, rabbinic Torah, oral Torah. And sometimes they go together, sometimes they don't go together. But his entire purpose is to show that it's one synthesized body of work. And therefore, you can't argue with rabbinic Judaism anymore. Because the rabbis didn't pick a rabbit out of a hat. They read it directly into the words of the Torah. And if those of us around the room simply knew a little bit more, we would see it clear as day. It's that battle that we've been speaking about. I know Rabbi Kasorla spoke about it. I spoke about it. A pshat in drash. Literal interpretation, what I'll call rabbinic interpretation. And that comes to a head in the end of the 18th century, where people are finally questioning the validity of the rabbinic Judaism. And when they do that, essentially you undermine the entire essence of Judaism as we know it, because we all know you could read the Torah and still not know how to be a practicing Jew. Most of what we get practically is from the rabbinic texts. Well, if the rabbis can say some far-fetched thing about Dina in a box or etc., 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 then they can make up halachos as well. And if they can make up halacha, then I can make a halacha, because what makes them any better than me? So he's trying to reinstill a sense of validity to rabbinic Judaism, and he does that in his work called Haktav VeHaKabbalah. I will be honest, it's not the easiest to read. It's very linguistic in nature, because what he's trying to do is explain the literal words of the text. So without an English translation, it's difficult. It's also not, I don't think they put out a new publishing for a long time, so it's not broken up, right? Have they recently? Of course there's a new one. After I prepare this class, I find out there's a new one. What? Hebrew. Oh, so I'll get to that. Okay? Oh, and frequently cited the Vilna Gaon. And that's going to be important. Okay? And I'll show you why in just a second. When I talk about Königsberg, Prussia, you're talking about the B on the map. Okay? Now, as I point out using a Google map, this is technology at its best. Königsberg, not literally, but figuratively and somewhat literally, sits in between two major centers of Jewish thought at that time. Number one is Berlin. Berlin, of course, is the epicenter of the Enlightenment. It's the epicenter of the reformists, okay? Where German is being studied and languages are being studied, and there's a tremendous opening. There's an openness to secular society around you. And on the left side of the ring, you have Vilna. Okay? Vilna, of course, is in Lithuania, which is much more representative of the traditionalist approach. Okay? Now that's why I said in my last note that he quotes the Vilna Gaon a lot. Because the Vilna Gaon represents the influence coming this way from Vilna, but there's also tremendous influence coming this way from Berlin. In Königsberg, in many respects, there's this battle taking place within the community that he is the rabbi, between the reformers and the traditionalists, represented by the geography of Königsberg, Prussia. Now, I mentioned that he quotes the Vilna Gaon a lot. Well, he also oftentimes in his works quotes many maskilim, many of the members of the Haskalah, many of the reformers. Now, that's unique. Not many rabbis will do that. A, because they're not versed in it, and B, they don't want to give any validity to them. Mecklenburg's not nervous about either of them. He's very well versed in it. He's fluent in German. He has a knowledge of Greek, Latin, and Arabic, and he refers it in his text all the time. Okay, I actually had to use Google some of the times to translate from German to English for me, because I had no idea what the German words are. But he references in almost every paragraph German words. Now that is a novelty, because not many biblical commentaries will reference and utilize the secular language that's surrounding them. The only reason you're going to do that is if what? Is if you want to speak to the people directly in their language. Okay? And so he's not going to be afraid to use German, which is considered much more of a progressive approach. And he's not going to be afraid to quote leading maskilim of the time, leading reformers of the time. Why? Because what's the best way to argue with someone? To quote them and then show how they're wrong. Similar, by the way, if you remember from the Radak 3 weeks ago, very similar to what the Radak does in his work. The Radak very overtly says, this is how the Christians use the text, and this is how I'm going to use the text. That's the best way to combat how they're going to misconstrue the text. This is a letter, for a variety of reasons, as you can tell, I couldn't find a better version of it, but you'll take my word for it. Okay. Goals of Haktav VeHaKabbalah. Okay? The goals are pretty simple. Number one, to unify the written Torah and the oral Torah. Okay? The introduction to Ketuvot VeKabbalah is fascinating. Fascinating. He asks some unbelievable questions. So if you open up your source booklet to page number one, well, it's source number one. I am going to read it in Hebrew because when I personally learn, I get more into the kishkas of the text when I read in Hebrew. But I'm going to translate it, and you have the translation there. So you could tune me out if you don't want to hear the Hebrew. You can choose to just read the English. But again, I get more passionate about... If I read English, I'm reading a text. If I read Hebrew, it forces me to focus on it a little bit more. So I'm going to read the Hebrew and translate as I go along. You can just read the English. Kvar hitoru mechabrim gedolim. Many wonderful authors have already wondered. Ma hayta kavanat notena Torah yitbarach. What was God thinking? B'mesirat ha-Torah shebal peh chutz min ha-ketav. Right? It's the most obvious question about Judaism. Why do we have an oral Torah and a written Torah? If you come into Shul on Shabbos, you're going to see a chumash like this. This chumash is the written Torah. Try practicing Judaism by just looking at this text. You're not going to be able to. So we have an oral Torah. The Gemara, that's what we've been discussing for the last year and a half. The Gemara, the Midrashim, etc., the Mishnayos, etc., etc., etc. So asks Rav Yaakov Zvi Mecklenburg, did you ever stop to wonder why you need both of them? If I were God, which my wife will tell you I am not, right? If I were God, it's our anniversary, I can make jokes like that. If I were God, yeah, don't think I didn't get grief. By the way, I hope you guys know how much I love you. On my anniversary, I'm sitting here teaching this class, right? So if I were God, I would write one Torah. And I would make it a heck of a lot simpler than the Torah that we have. Right? It's very confusing, the system that God created. Where you have to read a verse, then you have to go to the Mishnah, then you have to go to the Gemara. We could have avoided the last year and a half of learning if God just made the Torah a little bit easier. So that's where Mecklenburg asks. Ki'elu ha-dvarim, ki'elu hayu ha-dvarim kulam ketubim, umesurim al-sefer. If God had just handed over everything on a silver platter, so to speak, haynu nitzulim mikama machlokes, asher naflu bein chachmeinu rishonim v'achronim. We could have avoided generations of disputes and fights about what the correct path of Torah is. Ad she'amru ... Ma she'ein kein elu nichtavu b'sefer Torah Elokim. This doesn't happen, right? Right? Not only would we have avoided many internal fights, but think about how many people misunderstood the Torah simply because the Torah is so darn confusing. And so if I were God, what would I have done? I would have created one Torah. And I would have handed it to everyone in a nice bound, leather-bound book, beautiful bar mitzvah present, right? And that would be the end of it. Trust me, I could still study it. There are history books that people study for years and years and years. So Mecklenburg wants to know, why does God construct the Torah in this fashion? In source number two, he asks a separate question. Separate but similar. He says, I'll just read the English, the more intelligent a person is, he will be more economical with his speech. This is how wise men act. They maintain an economy of speech. In other words, again, he wonders why the Torah Shebichtav, the written scripture, is so enigmatic in nature. Why it's so abbreviated and why you need thousands and thousands of years of rabbinic texts to come along and explain it. Okay, so those are all the questions that he's asking. But again, why is he asking them? Because he wants to unify the written and the oral Torah. As I mentioned earlier, why does he want to unify the written and the oral Torah? Because if you unify the two of them, what can't reformers do? They can't drive a wedge right between them. Okay? In other words, no one's going to disagree with the written Torah. You can disagree with the rabbis, but if those two are inextricably linked, it becomes much more harder to combat that theology. Okay? Goal number two is to explain the Torah according to its pshat, thereby unifying it with oral law, as I was describing earlier. Right? To describe how all of these midrashim are really the text of the Torah itself. He believed that a proper understanding of the language of the Bible would allow one to discern its more profound meaning, which corresponds to the teachings of oral law. Again, why don't I understand why Rashi is a literal interpretation of the text? Because I lack a proper understanding of the language of the Bible. And that's why I don't understand it. But he says, I'm going to come and I'm going to enlighten you and show you how the two are inextricably linked. And lastly, he says, don't say that the Torah consists of two distinct and mutually complementary works. It's not the oral law and the written law. It's the Torah. Okay? And once those two are connected, as we described, it becomes much harder to break them apart. Rather, the two corpora together form a larger unity, which components, I assume that meant, whose components are comparable to a body and a soul. A large portion of his introduction is describing the written Torah and the oral Torah to a body and a soul. And I'll share with you one quote in English, and then we'll look on our source sheets in a second. He says, the only difference between the drash and the pshat is that which distinguishes the outside of the vessel from its contents. In other words, it's all part of the same vessel. You can't have one without the other, but it just represents two sides of the coin, so to speak. Okay, so if you look in your source sheets, on page number 3, again, he develops for about 4 pages this concept of the body and soul, but I just want to share with you a few snippets. In the first 4, we'll read the English, and the last one I might read a little bit of Hebrew. He says, it appears to me the following. God acted in the giving the Torah just as he acts with all creations, because all creations of the world are a combination of the physical body and soul. Rabbi Goldberg gave an entire Shabbat Shuvah drasha about, we might feel that we have a physical body, but we really are a soul. We simply have a body that creates a vessel for that soul. Well, says Rav Mecklenburg, it's not just people who have that sort of dynamic going on, but the Torah itself, he's going to argue, has that combination of a body and a soul. And the part that you can see, the part that sits on the outside, and part that might be hidden underneath. In the second quote, he says, in every creation, the soul is the essence. And without that essence, there is nothing real. And the physical body is simply the vessel to hold the soul. Because without the vessel, the soul is nothing. In other words, you need both. You need the body and the soul. Without the soul, the body is just a lifeless slab of meat. But without a body, the soul is unconfined. It needs something to contain it. It needs something to give it a sense of vibrancy. Okay? And the third quote, so too our Torah from Hashem, whose entire purpose is to share the will of God with mankind and how to behave as God wants. This too has a revealed and a hidden component. Next quote. The oral law is the soul that is hidden, and the vessel that maintains it is the written law that is revealed. Okay? So while you might be looking at me right now and seeing a body, the body is just a front. What's really inside of me, you can't really see that well. You have to dig a little bit deeper to find. Well, says Rav Mecklenburg, that's the exact same dynamic that we have to the two Torahs. I look at this text, the Torah Shebichtav, and I see like a body. But you have to look inside that to find the real essence of what we're looking for, which is going to be the oral law. And lastly, he says, the same way that the body gives clues to the soul on the inside, so too the written Torah gives clues to reveal parts of the hidden Torah. In other words, you can look at me right now, and if I brought a piece of paper and asked you to describe how I'm feeling spiritually, you could use certain cues that I give off physically to guess how I'm feeling spiritually. For example, because I'll talk about it in terms of a smile. Right? When a person's smiling, that's usually representative of a certain serenity on the inside, a peacefulness on the inside. Right? We give off cues physically to give people insight into what we're feeling on the inside. Okay? Says Rav Mecklenburg, that's the exact same way with the Torah. We have the Torah which is on the outside. So how are you going to find out what's really going on the inside? Well, we have a series of clues, which are going to be, for example, the 13 principles of how we deduce things from the Torah, the Yud Gimel Midot that we say every morning in Davening. The Torah gives us tools to find the soul within the body. Yeah.
Because without the vessel, the soul is nothing. I mean, just talking about Torah, how can you say the soul is nothing? And then later on,
so
at the bottom, when you're saying it's translated, the body gives
right. Right, no, I understand.
No,
I understand.
They make it the most incredible person.
No, 100%, 100%.
I can't imagine that all these things he said was really acceptable.
Well, I'll say two things. Number one, anything in English he didn't say. Anything in English I said, and I would not put my translation in a JPS Tanakh. Let's put it that way, okay? Unless anyone wanted to sponsor a $450 volume of his works, these are my translations. So they're loose translations meant to convey a concept. They're not literal translations by any stretch of the imagination. So if I were to retranslate it, for example, and spend more time retranslating it, so I may not have said the soul is nothing, but certainly the soul loses its ability to function as properly without the body. That's why we have a body. That's why we're here in this world with a body, so that we can manifest parts of the soul. So he's going to say that's the exact same dynamic between the Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaalpeh. You need one for the other. They're mutually dependent on each other, and that's his point down below. With regard to the hideous person, I understand your point, but I hope you also understand what he's trying to convey. Again, he's not being literal here. He's trying to convey a message, which is, again, when you see someone smile, don't think of it in terms of body and soul. When you see someone smile, so you see that person, you generally think they're a happy person, peaceful person. Right now, of course, people could be tormented on the inside, 100%. But we give off cues externally to represent things internally about us. Okay? By our energy level. This has been studied. It's called nonverbal cues. Okay? So he's simply saying that the same way we generally do that, the Torah does that as well. Because otherwise, how are you going to understand the oral Torah? How are you going to know to properly deduce things? You're going to know it by looking for those external cues. Okay. Goals of the Ketava Kabbalah number 2. This is very interesting. He markedly distances himself from the traditionalism of pre-modern Orthodox Jewry. Again, don't forget, new times call for new methods, which was comfortable acknowledging that only a small portion of rabbinic law derived from tradition, which has a much larger portion was all too readily produced by means of exegesis. What that means is that many biblical commentaries up until that point were perfectly okay accepting that there's the text of the Torah, there's rabbinic Judaism, the two of them don't have to make 100% sense, but we'll accept it nonetheless. Okay? He distances himself from that. And as I mentioned earlier, the Reformers adopted the traditionalist approach, in other words, the pre-Mecklenburg approach, to justify their challenge to rabbinic laws and practices. After all, if the rabbis aren't based on the text of the Torah, well then you're a rabbi, I'm a rabbi, what makes you any more correct than I am? And therefore, if you said certain things that I don't like, I can come along and reinterpret them. Okay? Next point. Why is the Torah so ambiguous? So this is another beautiful quote. When the formulation of the norm allows for other interpretations, the decision to comply with the only one that is identified as authoritatively expressing the will of the legislator, here God, requires much greater self-control. In other words, why do we have multiple interpretations of the Torah? Why is the Torah left purposefully ambiguous? Because he says if it's left purposefully ambiguous and I obviously have what I think about the Torah and you think about what you have think about the Torah and you think each of us have our own interpretation. But then we look in a Gemara, we look in a Talmudic text, and we say that that's how the rabbis interpret that. So I have two options. I can disregard what the rabbis say and satisfy myself with my own interpretation. Or I can say, I'm going to submit myself to what the rabbis say. So that's what he says here. Requires a much greater self-control. Thus, complying with the laws of the Torah as God wants them observed requires suppressing one's intellectual independence and submitting to the one interpretation preserved by tradition that definitively represents what God desires. So he says, when we see the Torah, we have a choice to make. And if you look on source number 4, which we'll read inside very quickly, he articulates the concept, which is basically that there is a battle going on inside people. Now, one battle is what we'll call the Yetzirah, the classic Yetzirah. Do I keep Shabbos? Do I not keep Shabbos? It's a lot easier not to keep Shabbos, but I'll suppress my evil inclination. I'll keep Shabbos. I really want the cheeseburger, but I know I'm not supposed to have the cheeseburger. But the Torah tells me I'll suppress myself and not have the cheeseburger. Okay? That's one evil inclination. He says, then there's an external evil inclination, which says, even if you're going to, so to speak, follow the Torah, I have to suppress, and again, this is an interesting approach that he writes. We'll see. I have to suppress my own intellectual independence in deference to how the rabbis interpreted the Torah. Okay? So if I asked you, we read a pasuk in the Torah, and I asked everyone to describe the pasuk in the Torah, I might get 100 different answers right now. But that doesn't mean that there are 100 correct different answers. And he says part of what you have to do in what we'll call, what he'll call traditional Judaism, is suppress your own intellectual independence in deference to the rabbis. Okay, so let's just look quickly on slide source number 4. He says, aside from the inner battle that person has with the evil inclination, there's another battle being waged with what is outside of him, not to follow interpretation of scriptures that are not true. If you overcome this great virtue because this battle is harder for a person, the reward is also greater. Now again, why does he write this in his introduction to his book? Because this is the battle of the day and age. You have people trying to reinterpret the Torah in a way that he believes is incorrect. And so he says, of course there are many interpretations of the Torah. Right? You reformers, and anyone else by the way, can think of, understand a pasuk any way they want, but that doesn't mean it's the correct approach. And that doesn't mean it's the approach that should be held going forward. Okay. Next point. As we referenced earlier, one of the reasons he said we can't understand how the rabbinic interpretation factors into the literal interpretation is because we simply don't understand the Hebrew language. Okay? And therefore, to one who cannot appreciate the profundity of biblical language, scripture will appear ambiguous, perhaps leading him or her away from the intended behavior. So if I don't understand the text and I look at it, and I'm simply going with whatever education I have, I'll understand it the way I want, but that could be incorrect. Because of this danger, the intended meaning of the text must be controlled. And this can be done only by means of tradition. Right? We don't have the luxury, he argues, to simply make up our own interpretations of the text. We are bound by how tradition has dictated we understand the text itself. It is tradition that will come and say the words in question demand X and do not demand Y. Right? Certain things are in the purview of tradition. Certain things are outside of the purview. And lastly, the rabbis were uniquely talented linguists with insight into the Hebrew language, able to show that traditional laws rendering certain animals illegible are actually promulgated in Scripture. In other words, they understood how certain words matched up to certain concepts. If we don't understand those words, we just see the concepts. We don't understand where they pulled it from. Let me give you an example. Okay? I'll wait a second to give you an example. For the Berlin Maskilim, the interpretations of the rabbis are a product of independent rational application of their linguistic expertise. In other words, according to the reformers, they pulled it out of thin air. And if they do that, they portray the rabbis as freely and independently interpreting the text of the Torah. Well, as I mentioned earlier, if the rabbis can freely interpret it, then I can as well. And therefore, by doing this, you undermine the rabbi's authority, but also give credibility to your own reform interpretation, even if it disagrees with the rabbis. Right? If they can say something, then I can say something. Comes along with Mecklenburg and says, whoa, 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 whoa. It's not so simple. Because it's not the oral law and the written law. It's the Torah. And you can't drive a wedge in between them. What we perceive as this ambiguity is really, as we'll see in a quote in a second, an optical illusion. It's simply because we don't understand the text well enough. Let me give you an example to make it a little bit clear. Okay? This is from the beginning of Vayikra. Dabera b'nei Yisrael ve'amarta alehem, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, Adam ki akriv mikem korban l'Adonai, when a man amongst you brings a sacrifice, amongst you brings a sacrifice to Hashem, min ha-be'ima, from the animal, min ha-bakar, from the cattle, u'min ha-tzon, or from the flock, takrivus korban lechem, you can bring your sacrifices. Now if I were writing the text of the Torah, which again I did not, right? I would just say, from animals, comma, cattle, comma, or flock, comma, or whatever, right? So why do you need the mean, and mean? So comes along the Sifra, which is the... No one remembers? Okay? The Midrashic text on the Torah. And says loosely, the phrases from come to exclude different types of cattle and sheep. Okay, so the extra words in the Torah are exclusionary. What are they trying to exclude? Those who have been involved in sexual behavior with mankind, bestiality, those who have been used in idolatrous rites, and the trefa, in other words, an animal that's been killed inappropriately. Okay? So the extra words comes along Chazal and say come to exclude three specific categories. Can I do a favor? Can you just close those doors? Right? Comes to exclude specific categories of animals that you're not allowed to bring for a korban. Okay? Now, if I'm reading this, I have a couple of options. I can accept it and simply say the rabbis are smarter than me. They obviously had a reason for why they picked idolatrous, bestiality, trefa. Right? Or I can say the rabbis clearly picked this out of thin air. In other words, they're random examples. And there's no rhyme and reason. Like, in other words, does anyone here, I'll ask a question. Does anyone here see how you get these bestiality, idolatry, and trefa from the word min, and min? No. No, I mean, anyone? No? Zmira? No? Right? The answer is no. Which again, you could easily deduce that the rabbis just kind of made it up a little bit. They picked three examples. Well, they picked three examples. I could pick three examples. And that undermines the validity of rabbinic texts. So what does Reb Mecklenburg come along and do? He says, not so fast. Because if you look back at our pasuk, he's going to highlight a different word. Which is the word bakar. Okay, the word bakar, anyone want to translate that again for us?
Cattle.
So again, that's how we in our, and again, I hope I'm not insulting anyone here, but I'll talk to myself. I don't know any better, so I translate it as cattle. But if I were a master linguist, like Reb Mecklenburg, so I would know that bakar indicates the capacity for plow. Now again, he doesn't pull that out of thin air. I'm happy to show it to you, but he spends about a paragraph citing scriptural examples of how bakar specifically refers to plowing. And so therefore a sickly animal or a trefa is excluded from the word bakar. So what has he done? He's saying it's not that the rabbis picked these examples out of thin air, but it's actually found specifically within the text. And therefore at the end of his entire discourse on why bakar excludes a trefa, in other words an animal that's basically torn to shreds, he writes the following. I have treated this matter at some length to show that the rabbis derived their explanation from the roots of the words themselves and not from the exclusionary force of the word from. In other words, from the root of the word itself. Rabbinic Judaism is not a separate entity to scriptural Judaism. Rabbinic Judaism is built directly off of the words themselves. And therefore, if it's connected like this, then you can't argue with it. So again, he takes the words themselves to prove the validity of rabbinic Judaism. It's somewhat masterful, actually, if I do say so myself, and I didn't write this. Okay, I'll give you another example. Vayetze Yitzchak lasuach basadet. What does lasuach mean?
To walk or to speak?
So to walk, to speak, sicha, okay? How does our friend Mr. Artskill translate it? How does our friend Art Skrull translate it?
Pray.
Now wait a second. The rabbi, this is not just an isolated incident. Our entire mincha, right, mincha, in the Gemara is derived from this pasuk. Because Yitzchak daven that day, we too should daven mincha. Wait a second, right? The entire focus of mincha, the entire reason for mincha is based on a word in the Torah, which doesn't actually say what the rabbis say it said. Right? So now I could say, sicha, spoke, davening. It's not such a large jump to get from talking to davening. But if I want to be a nudnik, I would say, whoa, rabbis, very nice that you want to translate this as to pray, but that's not what the text says. Okay? And so therefore comes along Reb Mecklenburg and says, how do we know that lasuach means to daven? So again, in well over a paragraph, citing countless examples, he says how the word sach means to divert your mind to something else and to relieve burdening thoughts. So for example, hesech hadas, which means to like, you get it, you're distracting yourself. Okay? So he says the word sach means that something's troubling me and I'm trying to get that off of my chest. Okay? And therefore he says that's how the rabbis knew that it means to pray. Now again, is it still a little bit of a jump? Of course it's a little bit of a jump. But think about what he's trying to do conceptually. He's trying to show that now with his interpretation, I look back at the word lasuach, and it's no longer, oh, the rabbis picked the word pray out of left field, but rather it's based on the text itself. And I think I have one more example here. Yes, a couple more examples. This is our introduction to Avram Avinu at the beginning of Parshas Vayir. Let's read the text. God appeared to him and he was sitting at the entrance of the tent when the day was hot. What circumstance is the text describing here? It's not a trick. Well, it is a trick question, but I'm setting you up for the trick. After the Brit Milah. We all, right? This is what my son learns in kindergarten. Avram Avinu had a Brit Milah. It was the third day. He was in a tremendous amount of pain. God comes to visit him. Right? Whoa. Time out. That's a nice story. Makes for good Parsha sheets and discussions at my Shabbos table. But I'll buy you dinner at Asia if you tell me where you see that in the text. You don't see it. So if I want to question the validity of the text of the Torah, I'm going to look at this pasuk and say, rabbis, you're pulling stories out of left field. You can't really be serious about this whole Judaism thing because you're making stuff. I'll make my own stuff up. So again, comes along the Ketav HaKabbalah and says, how do we know that Avram was sick? Again, I just quoted the Rashi for you, but we all knew it. So listen to what Rav Mecklenburg says. He says, we have found a number of instances where the language appearing, namely Re'iyah, Vayira, okay, indicates visiting and inquiring after, the infirm. Okay, sorry about that. And I purposefully here brought the word Kranskenbisch, okay, which means visiting sick people. Okay, no, but I purposely quoted it because I wanted to show you how he uses the German words. Okay? As in, and then he gives a bunch of examples. To see Yoram, to see David, both are translated in Aramaic as to support. Exegetes have gone to great lengths to find a basis for this rabbinic reading. Right? People have been bending over backwards. How did the rabbis pull this from? But according to that which was explained, it is the meaning of the language itself. Okay, so the rabbis aren't pulling things out of left field. They're simply interpreting the words themselves. Now, you and I didn't know that because we're not linguists and educated enough to know that Vayera in 15 places in Tanakh means to be visiting the infirm. But that doesn't mean that there's a problem with the Torah. It means it's a problem with our education. And so he comes along and tries to highlight all of these examples. I'm going to have to hold them out. Obviously take questions afterwards. Okay. That's the end of section number one. Okay, the end of section number one of our discussion tonight is really the whole reason for why he wrote HaKetav VeHaKabbalah. And what I try to communicate is the whole purpose of trying to reconcile it or unifying the oral text and the written text is to preserve Rabbinic Judaism. If you preserve Rabbinic Judaism in a traditionalist fashion, so you've combated a reform mentality. Okay? What I want to do the rest of the time is discuss a very... It's directly related, and I'll show you at the end. We're going to divert a little bit, but we're going to come back to my thesis at the end, which is Rav Mecklenburg goes to great lengths to discuss the sins of our patriarchs and matriarchs. Okay? The Torah gives us many examples where if I was reading, would be troubled by the behavior of our avos and imos. Now, if you remember back to the Radak a few weeks ago, one of the things I highlighted in passing about the Radak was very... Does anyone remember? He was very honest, brutally honest, with the behavior of the... In that case, the matriarchs. Remember, he called out Sarah and said she didn't treat Hagar appropriately. He says we can learn from that, but she acted inappropriate. Okay? Rav Mecklenburg struggles with this exact issue. Were our patriarchs and matriarchs perfect? Okay, and if I were to think of a perfect Avram and Sarah, that would be what they look like. Okay? So were they perfect? Rav Mecklenburg believed that our avos and imaos, that our matriarchs and patriarchs were categorically perfect. That they never did anything inappropriate in their entire lives. Whoa. That's first of all, a far cry from the Radak. What do we then also have to show? I could list 10 stories off the top of my head where it seems that one of our matriarchs or patriarchs sinned. And he spends a tremendous amount of time in the text itself struggling with these passages and showing how you really thought Avram was sitting there, Avram wasn't sitting there. You really thought that Sarah wasn't doing anything wrong. Okay, and I'm going to show you in a second. Okay, so we're our matriarchs and patriarchs. This is from an article in Sinai Mag, which is a Hebrew publication. I translated it. He says, the author defends the patriarch's honor, making allowance for an apparent misdeed, justifying their conduct through his explanation. Justifies everything. Okay? Shows how even though we think it may have been misguided, we are the ones who are misguided. Again, a quote from an introduction to one of the earlier works of Aktav HaKabbalah. He says, the lives of the patriarchs must be an example and model for all to follow. Right? The Torah wouldn't quote imperfect people. We're supposed to follow them. And he therefore endeavors to defend everything that looks like a blemish in their behavior. He refuses to accept that Avram, or Yitzchak, or Yaakov, or Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah, that any of them sinned. And therefore he goes to great lengths in his commentary itself, in the parts of the Torah where it looks like they're sinning, to show that they're not sinning after all. Okay, how does he do this? So number one is a historical assumption. The historical assumption says that the patriarchs and matriarchs were exemplary figures. It is inconceivable that they committed a sin. Historically, he can't wrap his head around the fact that someone so perfect would ever commit a sin. Okay, now I want you thinking, because I'll say it at the end. But just so I kind of guide your thinking, why am I sharing this with you in contrast to the first part of the class? Right? I mean, there are many other aspects of his life I could have shared with you tonight. I'm specifically highlighting this one. So think about why this was so important to him in light of what we discussed at the beginning of the class. So number one is he refuses to accept that anyone so holy could ever commit a sin or be misguided or deceitful or any of the above. Okay? Therefore, when he is concerned with a misdeed, in other words, parts of the Torah that we would look at and say, oh, Avram did something wrong there, or Yitzchak did something wrong there, he'll use an expressive phrase of greatness or reverence. So he'll introduce it. I gave some examples. The sacred matriarch. The righteous one. When he refers, for example, one of the cases of Avram, he calls him the elect of the patriarchs. You know, why does he do that? It's basically a little, right? You think that Avram is being imperfect here. I just want to remind you that this is the Avram Avinu, the perfect, the holy one, the righteous one, the sacred one, the elect one. Okay, so he uses those words purposefully to guide our thinking and to make us believe that they were perfect. He will often use the words chalila, like God forbid, or tama, like I'm astonished, to describe a classic understanding of a sinful episode. Right, so he'll quote the episode, he'll quote the way you and I probably interpreted the episode, and he'll say, chalila, God forbid you would interpret the story the way everyone else does. Or, I'm astonished that there are those who could actually believe that Yaakov would have deceived Laban. Because Yaakov is a perfect person. How could he have deceived someone? Okay? And he'll stress the gravity of the offense, but then say it's impossible for someone so holy to do that. In other words, I'll give you an example, and I don't remember if I give this example, but let's take the examples of Yaakov stealing the firstborn rights. So if you read the text of the Torah, it seems like Yaakov is quite a deceitful person. So he'll say, if someone were to be that deceitful, it would be horrible, it would be reprehensible, they should be, right? Terrible, terrible, terrible. And therefore, it can't be that Yaakov did that, because Yaakov, after all, is perfect. There's no way he could do something that is perceived in such a horrific fashion. Okay, let me give you some examples. Vayikra Yosef et Shema Bechor Menashe. This was from a couple weeks ago, the Parsha. Yosef calls his oldest son Menashe. Ki nashani Elohim es kol amali ves kol beis avi, because God has made me forget all of my toil in my father's house. Okay? In other words, Yosef is promoting the fact that he forgot Yaakov's house. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Yeah. That's a bad thing. Right? If I'm Yosef, Yosef HaTzadik, Yosef the righteous one, I don't want him disassociating himself with Yaakov's house. I want him to say, I remember my dad, even though I'm in exile, he's at the forefront of my mind all the time. I speak him at him every night, I kiss his picture before I go to bed, right? That's what I want Yosef to be doing. And yet he names his firstborn son, oh, that old guy, that old rabbi, I want nothing to do with him again. Okay? That seems like Yosef did something bad. So comes along Remecklenburg and says, this seems to be unfitting utterance, even on the part of a common person. In other words, he says, like, what person would speak that way about their father? It's atrocious behavior, even for one of us. How much more so for a distinguished person like him? Okay, so that's a great example. If you were a normal person, it would be a despicable behavior. But because you're a righteous person, I can't even wrap my head around the fact that you would do that. So how does he interpret it? I didn't quote inside because I didn't have enough time to translate it, and I didn't want to bring in the Hebrew if I couldn't translate it. But he says, no, it must be that Yosef was such a righteous individual that he refused to undermine God's plan. Right? God's plan was for him to end up in Egypt and for him to become the viceroy. And Yosef knew that if he remembered his father's household too long, it would cause him such pain that he would be forced to reveal himself, and he would be forced to undermine the entire process. And so he specifically tries to make himself forget in such a holy way, just so that he can allow God's plan to play out. And so what did Remecklenburg do? He took a story that seems a little bit troubling to us, and he says, Yosef was the paradigm of virtue. He was the biggest tzaddik in the world. He suppressed his own pain to allow God's utopian vision to play itself out. Okay? Not the way we naturally would have read it, but he does that to defend the behavior of Yosef, to show that, God forbid, Yosef can't be doing anything wrong. It must be that Yosef's perfect. Okay? Another example. This is from, I don't even really get into the details, because if you're not familiar with the story, it's just a bizarre story. But Yaakov basically tricks Laban. If you recall, he sets up this whole thing with speckled animals and his business dealing, and basically it's a really long part of the Torah, very confusing. But one thing becomes clear, and that is that Yaakov dupes Laban. Okay, he basically cheats him. Okay? Now again, if I'm reading that, and I'm looking at Yaakov, the great patriarch, how could he ever sin, deceiving someone who welcomed him in and gave him room and board while he was running away from his brother Esau, right? So what does he do? He says, how the commentaries have struggled to reconcile the behavior of Yaakov, the elect of the patriarchs, in such a deceptive way, which would be improper even for the least person and a stranger. In other words, even a petty person like me, I would never treat my uncle that way. And the elect of the patriarchs behaved so towards his father-in-law and his mother's brother. How could Yaakov behave that way? And so then he goes on for the next page of his text to show how Yaakov wasn't really behaving so wrong. We just misunderstood the text. You have to read it a little bit differently. Let me bend into a pretzel. I'll figure it all out. I'll wrap it up with a bow and deliver it to you and make you think Yaakov's still a righteous person. Okay? That's number one. Number one is historical. Number two is historiographic assumption. He says the Torah only lists actions by our forefathers that it wishes us to emulate. Therefore, if something is listed, it must be perfect. In other words, presumption number one is that the Avos and Imaos are perfect. Matriarchs and patriarchs are perfect. Presumption number two is that even if they did act inappropriately at some parts of their life, the Torah never would have recorded that, because the Torah is a book of, especially Bereishis, is showcasing for us models of behavior. And so therefore, there's no way they would have listed something that's imperfect. It must be. It's perfect. And for example, he'll say, this is a line from his commentary, is that the way of the Torah to speak unfavorably of the righteous? No, he can't comprehend, even if, let's say, they misbehaved, that the Torah would actually record it that way. Because the Torah is a perfect book. And the Torah is recording a perfect book about perfect people, so that we can emulate it, we can become perfect people. It's a markedly different approach from the Radak's approach, which is, you know, let the hair out, show all of our warts and bruises, and you can learn from that. He says, no, 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 the Torah would never do that. The Torah is a perfect book. The Torah wants its people to be perfect as well. Okay? And therefore, he argues that no patriarchal or matriarchal sin is found in the Torah. And therefore, if it appears to be a sin, it needs to be reinterpreted. The ideal personality portrayed in the Torah is seen to be innocent of any misdeed. Again, he's describing the Ketav VaKabbalah's text. What seemed at first sight to be an offense turns out to be a mere optical illusion on the reader's part. Again, we simply didn't understand the text well enough, but if you reinterpret the text, you could always find a way to make it that our patriarchs and matriarchs were perfect. Again, I would have brought more examples, it's just with the English translation, it was very difficult, but he goes through every story you've ever struggled with. Yaakov deceiving. Do I bring a couple of them here? Yeah, I give examples. Okay. No matriarch, no sins. So example number one. Vayomer Adonai Elohim Bama Eda Ki Irashena. Who's this talking about? Avram, right? Avram, at the Bris Bein HaBesarim, God promises him all these things. And what does Avram say back to God? How can I trust you? Ooh, wait a second. If Avram has perfect belief in God, so how could he question God? Right? Isn't that chutzpah? It's like when, you know, I tell my son, you know, I'm gonna whatever, and he says, I don't trust you, Daddy. Right? So Avram is perfect. How could he not trust God? And so what he does is he says, this is not an informative question. In other words, he's not saying, how will I know? Rather, he just says it's an exclamation. He says he's so exciting, like, oh my goodness, how am I going to know when it happens to me? Right? Who buys that? It's a stretch. But he feels compelled to stretch because he can't understand any other way to understand the text. Right? His entire purpose, his entire understanding is to say that they can't be sinning, so I have to figure out another way. I'll give you another example. Vayomer Yaakov michra bayom et bichoratcha li. Yaakov said, sell me the firstborn, the birthright. Okay, now, who here thought Yaakov was acting in a virtuous fashion? Well, his brother comes in from the field after a long, hard day of work. He's dehydrated. He needs an IV. He needs to be taken to the emergency room. He's plopping on the ground. All of a sudden, Yaakov says, oh, I'll give you a ride to the emergency room on one condition. Right? First, give me $100. Okay, now, if I did that to any of you, okay, what would you call me? A scumbag. He'd say, what kind of person are you? Your brother comes in, he's starving, you give him a little soup. And Yaakov's sitting there handling him, I'll only give you a little soup, I'll set up the IV if you promise me to give me eternal bliss, right? So how does he interpret that? He says Yaakov is simply stating a fact that the birthright had been sold. In other words, simply recording. It's not saying, Yaakov said to Esau, if you do this, I will. He's simply saying, Vayomer Yaakov, michra bayomet. Oh, by the way, I want the reader to know that at some point today, Yaakov and Esav had a transaction, and the firstborn rights were sold. So again, he took the exact same text, he just changed the way he read the text. And that goes from making Yaakov to be this scumbag, deceitful person, to just a recorder of information. Okay? Another example. Vaydor Yaakov neder lemor. This is in Parshas Vayeshev, right after God reveals himself to Yaakov at Har Moriah and tells him all these wonderful things that are going to happen to him. So what does Yaakov say? Right? If God, you'll be with me and you'll guard me and you'll give me bread and garments to wear, then I'll go along with this whole plan. So again, we negotiate with God that way. God says, I'll give you presents, you just have to follow me. He'll say, all right, God, here's the deal. I want to win the Mega Millions tonight. I want my kid to get into this college. I want the new car. I want the new house. If you give me that, then you got yourself a deal. Who does that? Right? And so he interprets it and he says, no. The word im, I'm sorry, it's hard to read down here. There should be a not there. Im does not mean if, in a conditional sense. In other words, if you do this, God, but as an emphatic, like, God, when you will do this, then I'm going to be on board. So he's not questioning God, he's making a statement about God. God, I know you're going to do X, Y, and Z, and therefore I'm along for the ride. Again, so he takes three places where you can read into the text and say, maybe they lacked a certain sense of faith, maybe they were a little deceitful. He says, no, it's simply because we didn't understand them properly. Okay? Now here's where I'm getting to the connection between the first part of the class and the second part of the class. Sometimes he even defends the patriarchs or matriarchs, even when the rabbis themselves censure them. Okay? There are times in the Talmud where rabbinic texts will say that a rabbi has acted inappropriately. So what's Mecklenburg going to do with that? He's going to disregard the rabbinic texts. Wait a second. Mecklenburg, who's the defender of rabbinic texts, is now going to disregard the rabbinic texts? So this again from an introduction to later work. He says, the master's conflict with those who would detract from the sanctity of the written law or the authority, that's supposed to mean, or the authority of the oral law and its affinity with the written law inspired him to take great and special care to discern the exact meaning of every word, every letter in Scripture. Even of every letter in Scripture. This foreign position on the master's part, in fact, caused him to reject the interpretations of the rabbis themselves out of his intention to defend them. Okay? And that's the connection between the first part and the second. If the rabbis come along and say, Yaakov sinned, Mecklenburg is going to come along and say, no, rabbis, you were wrong, Yaakov didn't sin. Now, why is he going to disregard the rabbis? Doesn't that undermine the entire thesis of his work? The entire thesis of the work is to promote what the rabbis are saying. So Mecklenburg says, well, the rabbis are doing themselves a disservice. Because if they come along and say that Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov sinned, well, if our matriarchs and patriarchs were imperfect, then guess who else can be imperfect? The rabbis themselves. And if the rabbis themselves are imperfect, I no longer have to listen to them. I can make up my own interpretation. And so Mecklenburg is willing to break with the rabbis, to say that they're wrong and that our Avos and Imos are perfect, so that in the long run he can defend the rabbis themselves. In other words, his whole purpose is to show this almost perfectness to rabbinic tradition. In the same way, when it comes to the Gemara and the Midrashim and Rashi that manifests itself in combining the oral law and the written law, one of the ways you do that is by showing that our matriarchs and patriarchs were perfect. In the same way our matriarchs and patriarchs were perfect, rabbinic Judaism is perfect as well. And it's harmonious with the written law. And therefore you can't undermine it. You can't drive that wedge through it. So it's ironic. Again, he caused them to reject their interpretation to defend them. Because that's his whole purpose in writing his text, is to defend rabbinic Judaism. Okay? And you have, for further reading, I gave you examples of where I draw my sources from. So just to summarize, we started off with a time period where there was a question of how orthodoxy would adapt to massive changes that are ripping through Western Germany. Okay? And again, if you had asked people at that day and age if Orthodox Judaism would survive the onslaught of the reformers, the answer would have been no. And you have a select group of biblical commentaries who come along and say that I am going to figure out a way to defend rabbinic Judaism against those who are questioning it, and the way I'm going to do it is through my commentary on the Torah itself. Hakatav veHakabbalah, as the words themselves indicate. Hakatav, the scripture, veHakabbalah, the tradition. What Mecklenburg tries to do, and the way he takes on the reformers, is to say you can't simply disregard the rabbis and say that they're pulling Jewish law, Jewish theology out of thin air, and therefore you can construe your own formulations. Mecklenburg says, we simply don't understand the text of the Torah. And you can read at least 90% of rabbinic Judaism directly into the text, and that's why I gave you some of those examples, to show that stories that we thought were made up are really implicit in the text itself. We simply didn't understand it. And so Mecklenburg says it isn't the written Torah, the oral Torah, it's the entire corpus of Torah itself. Then we discuss the perfect image of the matriarchs and patriarchs. How Mecklenburg, countless times throughout his works, bends over backwards to show how our Avos and Imos were perfect, Avram was perfect, and Sarah was perfect. And the reason why he does that is because the same way that they're perfect, it bolsters the authority of rabbinic Judaism, which was the exact authority that he was trying to preserve. And that was his contribution to the discussion of traditionalism versus modernity in the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century, is his attempt to reconcile the written Torah with the oral Torah, that it's not two texts, but it is in fact one text.